I waited a while. My computer was 4.5 years old. It's missing a foot. I maxed out the hard drive space. What? So it was yelling. Yeah, a foot. You know the little things on the bottom?
Yeah. Do you have, like, furniture? What is this, like, one of those old TVs? It's really ornate computer. Is there a radio? Is there also a radio in your computer? It's an old steamer. Do you have to crank it? like an old car window?
No, he has hamsters for that.
Yeah.
I mean, how else do you get your exercise?
Hi, this is the first time we've had a guest. Right?
Oh, it is.
Beautiful. I feel special now. That's amazing.
You are super special. Robert, do you want to introduce yourself to our audience of one?
Of course. Thank you. So I'm Robert. I'm part of the DG Studios. We're out in LA. We do basically everything that has to do with online marketing, development of apps, of websites, everything that moves through code. And so we deal with projects from smaller projects for foundations. We love helping, for example, we work a lot with the Sri Lanka Foundation, and we help various other charities, and up to bigger corporations where we have infrastructure built internally for the teams, you know, for people working across multiple continents and so on. So from small to large, we tend to prefer larger projects because it's just more exciting for us. But the smaller ones are great also, especially if they have, you know, an impact on the business and on the people, because that's just like rewarding at the end. So that's us.
That's great.
Yeah.
What kind of things are you working on right now?
Well, there are various things I can't speak of and some I can, but the ones I can't speak of are more interesting. So I'm just not going to say names. So something we're building right now is, I find, fascinating and slightly scary at the same time. So we're building artificial intelligence software for a bank in the US to allow people to get a credit automatically. So it literally, you fill in all of the questions and everything that he has, the software automatically does a background check and tells you how much credit you can pull out, you know, from how you are right now. And that to me is very exciting that we can do that. At the same time, I really do not want to give that to the power of anyone, you know, on the internet to do that. It's just like, I don't think banks should do that. I understand it's productive, but I don't think it's effective.
That's so interesting.
It's very interesting for us. One that I can talk about, they're just launching, so their website is already online, is ThermoSensor. So they patented the technology, which literally they have a little pen. It's literally not bigger than a pen. It's just slightly thicker because it has like a screen on it. And you touch various parts of your skin, so wherever you have a rash or whatever, and it almost instantly tells you if it's cancerous, if you need to take any medication, the risk factor, and so on. So literally in a few seconds. And this will increase the productivity of dermatologists, you know, across the board in like everywhere on the planet. So literally, instead of getting tests and waiting 2 weeks and whatever, things like that, like with the samples and so on, you can find out in a few seconds. And if I remember correctly, the success ratio is like 90-something%. But the thing is that doctors, so real doctors, their success ratio is actually lower, because like 92% accurate. So this is like 96 or something like that. So
that's,
it's even
crazy,
more accurate than what doctors say. So that's beautiful. And we're also working with artificial intelligence on pinpointing, you know, like with pictures, how those things work and so on, and how they progress or digress, you know, in case you're healing. It's quite adventurous. So those are the type of projects we like.
Wow. That's awesome.
I don't know if I'm more surprised that they've built a tool that can do that, or that doctors were 92% accurate before that.
Well, I mean, after you figure it out, you know, like with everything, you sort of figure out the pattern. I mean, many people need to pay the price, you know, until you figure that out. But after you see, oh, well, they did die, so this means that it really was, you know, bad. So let's take that into consideration and next time figure it out faster, you know. And I just recently heard a TED talk that it blew my mind. There's a ratio. I can't remember how it's called, but it basically says how many people need to use a substance or a treatment until the treatment actually works. So for one medicine that's literally given across the board, it's as common as aspirin. I can't remember what it heals, but it has a ratio of 1 to 49. So literally 49 people have to take it until the medicine actually helps one person. Wow. You know, so literally it's 49 to 1 is the ratio. And the 48 people before that have no positive effect whatsoever. The only thing they do have is the side effects.
Oh, awesome. So, I love that.
Yeah,
so I love those commercials.
It's crazy.
About side effects.
It's crazy, yeah. Yeah. Oh my God.
Oh, it's so cool that we're in an industry with technology that we can start to kind of blend in and help others, like just medicine in general. I think that's something in the past I've been super interested in, you know, in terms of with design. A lot of the principles that we use to build software, you know, like slow incremental, you know, agile, iterative process.
Yeah.
Those things could be applied to other industries as well, especially in medicine. It's interesting though, it's hard because that's a whole different ball of wax, you know, academia and that kind of a thing. Is there a struggle there in terms of trying to kind of meld the two together?
As you mentioned, academia. So I do find all of these industries very, very specific. So medicine and medtech, we build medtech. So medicine is very different from academia as in education, mm-hmm. which is very different than the financial services, which is very, very different as, for example, insurance. We also help people with insurance, and especially now with GDPR. Luckily, all of our servers were secured and we didn't store information that we shouldn't have stored or things like that. But GDPR really affected a ton of people here in Europe. And it's crazy to see people because just so everyone on the podcast knows, GDPR is a law that was passed in 2016. So they literally gave people 2 years to prepare for GDPR, which went live in May this year, 2018. Mm-hmm. And everyone in like before May in April was like, oh my God, GDPR, this thing is actually going to happen. And the fines, if you're not compliant, are like $250,000, you know, the minimum fine. And many businesses don't make that much, you know, definitely not that much in profit, you know, so they can't afford to be uncompliant. So, but it's crazy because they thought about this when they passed the law and said, it's going to take a while for businesses to actually adopt this. So let's give them 2 years. Literally, right. No one did anything for 1.5 years. And then half year ago, consultants started taking that on because they knew it's coming. So like they started preparing. And just like 1 or 2 months ago, people actually started using it. So now we have 2 or even 3 people that are certified in GDPR, you know, and even so, one way we would hire in the past was that we would get, you know, all of the CVs from people from like the recruitment sites and so on. And we would literally store all of those and have like a big Excel spreadsheet with all of their numbers, emails, names, whatever, etc. So recently we were hiring developers and I asked my assistant, where's the sheet? Why don't you just give me the sheet? And she's like, we can't do sheets anymore. We're not allowed to store mm-hmm. their phone number anymore.
Right.
So like, oh my God, that's a thing. That's really a thing. We can't store their phone number. Just like it's in the CV, but they shared the CV with us. So that's fine, you know? Oh my God, it was crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just real.
I love how collectively it makes me feel better about my own procrastination that like collectively, like an entire population to waited a year, like a little shy under 2 years to do anything about this thing.
Oh,
that's so funny. Oh my God. Yeah, I didn't know it was passed like 2 years ago. I love that because everyone was scrambling. And then I got my inbox was flooded with all of these notices about how everything has been updated. I was like, oh, okay, this must be new. But nope, it's been a couple of years. I love the procrastination on the large scale. It's just very comforting.
Isn't that true of like all human nature? If you give us a deadline, we'll wait until the end of the, like, I wonder how many, like the percentage of companies that like got to that point before, like a couple months before the deadline.
Mm-hmm. Right. And who notified them? Because someone, not everyone was keeping track.
Yeah.
So who was that person? He was like, I've been telling you for the past 2 years, we gotta get our act together here.
I wonder how much those consultants made in the last few months I'm a GDPR expert.
That was like Christmas. Oh, yeah. That was like the retail Christmas of GDPR compliance. You know, if you haven't sold anything until Black Friday, that was the Black Friday of GDPR compliance.
Yeah.
April and May leading up to that. Biggest boom, I think, for them. And with regards of human nature, I feel the only reason or the only two reasons you procrastinate is, number one, you don't want to do it. So you really don't want to do it. And then number two, it's scary. So one of the two. Those are the two only reasons I feel people procrastinate. Because if you like it, if you really want to do it, and you feel competent in doing it, you're going to do it right now. That you actually want to do it. You're excited about doing it. So you never procrastinate on something you like doing and you're not scared of. You only procrastinate on things that either you're scared of, or you really don't want to do. So GDPR is one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. If you tell me that I have 2 years to do something... Mm-hmm. I mean, part of that is right. Unless I really want to do it, I'm going to wait 2 years.
Just stop
until until that deadline is closer. I'm going to push that off until I don't have to do it, until it's getting a lot closer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, let's say it's something very important to you, because if you have within your daily schedule, you have a ton of things already going on and you see the world through that perspective. So the reason you would put something aside for 2 years is because you have a bunch of other things going on. But let's say in the perspective of a world in which tomorrow you wouldn't have anything to do and you are given, here are 10 things that you can do. You just make your choice. You would literally start and work on the thing you love most and you feel most competent about, right? Or if you're like Tim Ferriss or whatever, you would just start salsa dancing or jujitsu or whatever, something that's very scary for you and you really wanted to experiment with, but it just goes in the same direction. So you won't procrastinate if you have the option not to.
I feel like the things I like doing just don't have deadlines. Mm-hmm. So the fact that there is a deadline on anything, it makes me not. I'm like, oh God, I don't want to do that.
that was exactly what I was going to say. Is just the fact that there is a deadline on it means that I probably don't want to do it.
Yeah, they're very helpful though for that last minute, for knowing what I'm going to do 12 hours before, like a date.
I actually away from using deadlines to using the concept of billing of time and resources and so on. And I just say, okay, I need to do this, whether it's a design, whether it's talking with the client or whether it's, a sales cycle or whatever goal it is. I just say, how many hours is this going to take me to do that? And so, for example, if it takes me, let's say 100 hours, because I've been doing this for 10, 15 years. So I more or less have a good estimate of how much something's going to take me. So let's say if it takes 100 hours, I just say, okay, it's going to take me 100 hours. If I put in 1 hour a day, it's going to take me whatever. How much is that? 20 weeks, But if I put in 4 hours a day, it's literally going to take me 1 month. So it just works like that. And I don't see deadlines anymore. I just see level of effort and I just keep myself accountable. And at the end, I measure, okay, I said this is going to take, and this is very useful in the agency business and everything we do, in the digital era, because everyone wants to know, I want to know the estimate. How much is this going to take?
Right.
And we just had a conversation with someone that wants to build an EPUB reader. And so for a very, very niche market, so they want to build an EPUB reader and they want us to put in that feature that you see in Kindle and in iBooks, where you can just literally select anything you want and then put a comment there or a note or keep it or bookmark it or whatever. And the module they use, because they worked with someone else previously, the module they use literally does not have the feature. So they want us to estimate how much it's going to take to go into the module and custom build an API that is then going to allow us, to build the code to make that work. And I said, we have no idea. It's a custom module. We've never worked with it, and it's so niched down that most dev agencies wouldn't have worked with it. So you literally need a discovery phase to figure out how much that's going to take,
Yeah. you know, I used to work in an agency where before I even met the client or even knew what the project was, kind of, I was asked by so many people, like, how many hours will this take? I'm like, oh my God, I don't even know what the project is. Like, and then you just start giving out fake numbers so they'll stop asking you.
Yeah.
And then you hope that it works out. But we here really try and avoid giving that kind of estimate. I think for us, we do it by time spent, really. So instead of telling a client, like, this feature is going to take this many hours, this many weeks, rather we take it in terms of, well, we'll see how important it still is in the coming weeks, like through testing. Like, it's a lot looser approach. And we just bill for time spent, you know, on the project. Mm-hmm. Which is, we found very helpful and flexible for us in case we come upon a discovery, you know, during the project that, well, hey, actually, we need more time. We should really dig into this. Mm-hmm. And it's been super helpful.
Yeah. I think when I do give estimations, it's always with a range so that people understand that this is a total guess. Mm-hmm. And I think I do the, like, typical, like, have an estimate, double it, and then double it again.
That's great. I love that equation.
Yeah, those are my two tricks. Mm. It's like, this is the low end, this is the high end. Mm. We think we'll be somewhere in between. And typically we always hit the high end. Mm. And then the other trick is like taking an estimate and doubling it and doubling it again. I think some of that is just like, it depends on the timeline too. Like, if you're estimating a story that is smaller, I think the doubling and doubling it again makes a lot of sense. If you're estimating a huge project, there's so much unknown involved in that, which is why we do time and materials contracts, that we don't want to be beholden to something. Even, like, I've started so many apps and, like, halfway through or even a couple weeks in, we're like, we need to pivot in a new direction. We need to change this business, so...
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that makes sense. Half of our projects are time and materials. Sometimes just the corporations are very, very keen on, okay, we want exactly this, let us know. And it's literally part of the RFQ, you know, like you literally, you know, say, okay, how much is this gonna cost? And then they make decision, then we hop on various calls, they interview our team, whatever, you know. So at the end of the day, we do prefer time and materials, but we do understand how businesses need to budget for whatever projects they have. So let's say you have, I don't know, $100,000 budget for R&D this year. You know, you want to make sure whatever you want to build is not going to pass that, you know, so it just makes sense.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. And we work with our clients to make sure if they do have a strict budget like that, to be like, okay, what are you hoping to get into this budget? And work with them week to week of like, what is feasible? Mm-hmm. I think that open communication is the most important thing throughout the project as concerning to the budget. I had a question based off of like the projects that you had mentioned early on. Like, it seems like the two projects you mentioned are dealing with like AI and probably some machine learning, and those are like heavily technical, but also there's probably some social cognitive things for people. Like when you first started talking about the bank, I think there's a trust thing there that like the first thing I thought to myself is like, I don't know if I would trust the bank's security enough to fill out all of that information. That might be I'm telling myself a lie because I'm sure I've filled out credit things online before. But like, I assume there's somewhat of a jump to just like seeing that right away because we're so conditioned to like talking to a human or through like in that situation. And the same thing could be said with the medical device. Like, if I have, I don't know how expensive it is, but like if that's affordable for someone to have at their house to like track their skin cancer or whatever it is, or when I go into the dermatologist and they just do that, like, am I still trusting the the years of school that the dermatologist had if they're just like relying on this device? So like, have you done like user interviews and testing to like see if people are able to make that cognitive leap or like okay or secure in those leaps?
So what's going to happen in the first instances, and I feel this is something that's going to happen across the board now that AI is more and more like in our lives, is that at the beginning, in the transitioning phase, you will always have a human interaction. So you will probably not buy the device. What you will do is you will go to a dermatologist. He will have the device. He will test right then and there. You will get your answer. And he will also take samples, and you will also go through the process, you know, of actually testing it to see if the device was accurate, you know. And this way, you don't need to trust the device because you already have, you know, the medical expertise of the doctor there that was probably recommended to you by someone and so on and so forth. After this happens, you know, like a million times across the board, doctors will just literally stop testing and just use the device if the device is accurate, of course. So same thing with banks. So it'll probably not give off the bat loans at the beginning. What it will do is go through all of the interview process. Because for example, when you go to a bank, if you know when you get the credit, they ask you a bunch of questions and send you paperwork. And so that takes a lot of time for the bank. So what I feel is that the AI will literally take all of that information, put everything, store it, and then feed that information into the customer support rep, you know, and then they will contact you and follow up and check and whatever. So you will still have the human interaction, but it will be much faster. And at one point, if literally 1 million times again, if it happens consistently well, then they'll just, everyone will start trusting it, you know.
That makes so much sense. As you're building these tools out, how are you testing that? Or are you testing that like interaction and making sure? And also, like, how are you testing the accuracy? And is that part of doing that still like manual process in terms of the dermatologist tool, like continuing to do essentially parallel tests? So like doing the test with the tool and then doing the normal test that they would have done before the tool, and just continuing to judge the accuracy of the tool and continuing to like build that trust for the dermatologist and build the trust with, I guess, the dermatologist patient too.
So in our industry, so we typically are hired to help. We are hired to support people that do not have the competencies that we have, the skill sets that we have. So what tends to happen is people prefer to have as many things internally, you know, in their own company as they can. And they only outsource things that they know they can get more value out of. So in 100% of the cases until now, clients do the test because they want to. So they want to take our software, they want to take our infrastructure and put it to the test in the real world. And then they do the test themselves and then come back and we work together, you know, to see what can be improved and so on. Like, for example, one of the things that the financial institution had is they were directly responsible, or a department of this, you know, banks and financial institutions theoretically are very, very large. They have a lot of departments, a lot of stakeholders and so on. So one of those departments was responsible to actually give us all of the questions we need to ask and in what order and so on and so forth. So we were given a very deliberate set of questions that our developers just literally built. You know, it's just that simple. If you tell me to ask this question at this moment, I'm going to do exactly that, you know. So we did that and we implemented it. It made sense. But then the final decision makers, you know, tested it and said, we can't give credit on the base of just these questions, you know, and they got super pissed and they came back to us like, this is crappy and so on. And then we just stayed a bit and like, who was responsible for giving the question?
Oh boy.
And then basically they found out that it was their team internally that was responsible to work with us to do that. And they just never did that. So it literally never happened. This fell off the board. So that's like politics and that things you need to deal with. But at the end of the day, the short answer to your question is that our clients tested. So they tested, they take everything back and then they make sure to give us feedback. And then after that, in most cases, it's time and material because you don't know how much feedback they're going to have and what you need to implement.
Yeah. I continually to tell people that the hardest part about building software isn't actually building it. It's the communication around it. And your example with the bank just kind of like highlighted that, which is like, just especially with big companies, like I assume this bank is, like having different departments talk to each other, getting the right people who are going to authorize, like, essentially, like, loans, or I don't know if it's loans or credit card or whatever, mortgages. But, like, I imagine those are big leaps, big asks that involve multiple departments inside the bank. And just to get them to talk sometimes is one of the hardest parts of our job.
Mm-hmm.
Get them to talk and get them all in a room or on a conference call. That is the worst. So yeah. It happens so many times. Yeah. We've been going with one of our other clients. We've been going back to schedule one half an hour to 60 minute meeting. We've been going back and forth for 3 weeks. 3 weeks.
Oh, God.
It's just one feedback meeting that literally is, we're doing nothing. It's all pencils down. We're literally doing something else because we can't wait, you know, 3 weeks to for them to just find the time in between the departments to work. And many times what happens, and of course we don't tell them because we're polite, but we get so pissed off when we have, you know, like five of them in a room and then halfway through, two of them just leave and they don't even tell us. And we just speak. And at one point they go, oh, that person left the room like 20 minutes ago. I'm like, what?
Oh, God. Right. Oh,
excuse me. You know I'm not there and I can't see you. Why didn't you just tell me? But yeah, it's communication. Yeah, I agree with Kyle completely.
Yeah, I was just in a design sprint. There was a lot of people in it too. And it was actually really great. I mean, there was 10 of us in the room. So sometimes that can be really hard to manage because, you know, it's getting everyone in the room, facilitating the conversation. Everyone has really good ideas and everyone was super passionate. But it's interesting. Like, I had to ask at one point, like, have y'all had a chance to actually sit in a room yet and talk about this? Because there was just a lot of ideas like flying around and it was all great. And there, you know, it was such a great experience though, because everyone was super respectful. No one talked over each other. Everyone let each other speak and everyone built upon other ideas. I was in like an oasis. It was just like amazing, but it was so much information. So those for sprints, it's sometimes hard too. Like when you're getting everyone to actually be there in a physical place, you know, sometimes teams they have a million things going on and they're kind of distracted and they are on their laptop. Like there's times in the past too where we have to explicitly say like no laptops for this session because people have emails, like people have other things they have to do. And like people are used to being in meetings and not being in a meeting, like doing something else while in a meeting. But for sprints and stuff, when you have to be there in person, that's, you can't really have that. But it's weird because you kind of sometimes go into this role of kind of babysitter in terms of like computers, like laptops down, pencils down, everyone. Like, do you need more time? Let's have a bio break. Oh, I hate that. Do you, Robert, have you guys done any design sprints? Do you facilitate any of those or like projects, like kickoffs and stuff?
Yeah, so typically what we have is we have various stages, as I'm sure you guys have as well. So we prefer to start with discovery always. Test assumptions, test like what they believe, talk to some of the people that are going to use the end product, you know, talk to the stakeholders, see if it's possible to actually build what they want to build. Like, we had a very interesting client in which that was the longest discovery phase ever. It took several months because we were trying to do something around, I don't know how much information I can say, but it was around protecting your child's privacy, basically. And how, because everyone has smartphones nowadays and you can just Instagram and Snapchat and WhatsApp and you can do so many things and you can literally, pictures are flying all across the internet, you know, and a 14-year-old doesn't really have any clue of what that means yet, you know, for their long-term reputation and so on. So, and safety, because many times you don't know who's on the other side, you know? So we were working back and forth with this company. Hey, is it possible? Is it not possible? What are we trying to accomplish and whatnot? It literally took us so much time to convince them we can't do it. And not just we can't, and most people won't be able to do it because they were literally expecting us to get all of the messages from WhatsApp and then filter them and then get the pics from Instagram and filter them and then Facebook Messenger and text messages and so on. And like, we can't do that. We literally, it's illegal. We cannot, it's against the policy of iOS and Android and all. You cannot hack into other apps. It just doesn't work that way. And I say, well, there must be a hack. Yes. And the moment you market yourself as the person that found a hack to get into WhatsApp, WhatsApp will just put 1,000 developers to find out what hack you found and just block you out. And then the $250,000 you invested into us finding a hack will literally be useless because they'll have more manpower to put into just fighting against us. And it'll be a constant battle you won't win against these giants, you know? So that's a discovery phase typically. But this was atypically long, so it lasted months. We were trying to explain. Wow. We did try to get, and we ended up working with them because they ended up trusting our judgment. Oh, hooray for that, you know. after that much time, they, at least that happened. So that was something good that came out of it. And we did work with them on various other things. So that ended up being good, fruitful. But so you have discovery. And then you have initial design, which is like storyboarding and UX design and doing things like that, discussing, going back and forth. After that, you have UI or polish, you know, where you agree on all of those things. And after that, you start development. So sometimes it goes very like waterfall-y, you know, it goes in this specific order. Other times with other people that are under deadlines, again, then they want everything to just start, you know, and just put 1 week into thinking about how it's going to act like, 1 week and thinking about how it's going to look like, and then start, you know. And so those are also more time and materials because like you need to go sprint and redesign and rejudge if your assumptions were correct and so on. So it just depends on what you have to deal with. But yeah, we do sprints all the time.
So I know we're kind of approaching time right now. I would love to know, so what's your favorite part of all those steps? What's the one that inspires you the most? Which one do you get the most out of?
I feel that I get most out of seeing the entire system work. Because I've been a programmer. I actually have a BA in engineering. So I love the geeky stuff. I've been a designer for a couple of years. I've been a marketer for a couple of years. I've been in sales for a couple of years. So I just been across the board. I understand how business works, how all of those things come together. Hence why I now have more strategic positions. And so I just find incredible peace in knowing that people know what they should be doing today, tomorrow, 1 week from now, 1 month from now, and things actually work and people actually get the results they were expecting. You know, that is my favorite part, making sure everyone's on the same page and people have their weekly meetings and then they understand what they need to do, you know, and so on and so forth. And at the end of the day, people get what they pay for, you know, and they're very happy. And then because many times especially for small businesses or for charities, it literally changes their entire business. It's literally life-changing for the business and for the people in it, you know? Or with the dermatologist, for example, it's industry-changing, you know? So seeing all of it, the entire process work, start to finish, for like from a top level, that for me is like most interesting.
Yeah, it's so fun when at the end of the day, you see what you can create with other people. Mm-hmm. And how sometimes like you can't do it alone, right? No. And for something as huge as that. So it's really cool to see everyone coming together and in the end, like, looks like, oh my God, we made this thing and it works. I love that. That's great.
Really is.
Anyway, Kyle, do you want to do the footnote stuff?
I don't know how to do the footnote stuff anymore.
So this is episode 55. Woohoo! 55, good number.
You can follow us on Twitter at TentativeFM. You can email us at host@tentativefm. You can get this episode at tentative.fm/55.
Yeah. Rate us on iTunes.
That too. Robert, do you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you, follow you, do whatever?
Yeah, so anyone can get in touch with us at dgstudio.com. We love adding value. We love helping everyone. If they just search for me, I have various roles at various companies, so that might be confusing, but they can find me on LinkedIn. I'm sure you guys will have my name in the footnotes. It's weirder to explain. It's Robert, which is simple, but then my family name screws it up. It's like I-N-D-R-I-E-S, Indriesh. So it's just complicated. Sorry about that.
No worries. We'll put it all in the footnotes. So
perfect.
Cool. Well, this is fun. Yeah. Thanks again, Robert, for being on the show.
Yeah, it was great talking with you.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye. Bye, guys.
I'm Derek.
I'm Sean.
And we host the Bike Shed.
We talk about the projects.
Sometimes we read code. It's very exciting.
Ooh. The people.
Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Vidahi.
Hi, Olivier.
Thanks for coming on, Sandy.
And everything else that influences our lives as developers.
Oh, like speed dating, but
yes,
for
exactly.
Employers.
Yes, and I was pretty sure it was going to be bad. And
was it?
It was bad.
So join us every Friday on the Bike Shed.
This podcast was brought to you by ThoughtBot. We are experienced designers and developers who turn your idea into the right product. With local studios in Boston, San Francisco, New York, London, Austin, and Raleigh, let's build something great together.